Chapter 24 Putingrad. In February 2013, Putin led a large entourage of Russian officials and members of the International Olympic Committee to Sochi for 2 days of meetings exactly a year ahead of the planned opening ceremony. He did not appear pleased. 5 years of construction had transformed the sleepy coastal resort. Putin's aides said for the better, his critics said ruinously so. The circular site of the main Olympic arenas in the Imeretinskaya Valley had been drained, graded, and cleared of the hundreds of modest homes and dachas nestled among estuaries that had been the nesting grounds of migratory birds. The arenas rose from the plain like alien objects, sleek and modern compared to the neoclassical remnants of Sochi's glorious Soviet past. Yet the valley remained a scarred, muddied landscape, littered with construction debris, studded with construction cranes that pivoted day and night. The construction was equally intense in the mountains at Krasnaya Polyana, where the Muzimta River churned murkily past the still incomplete railroad and highway. The scale of the work in the mountains and along Sochi's narrow coastline was staggering. 200 miles of new roads, dozens of tunnels and bridges, 8 new railroad stations, and 31 smaller stops. The new power station that Gazprom built and a network of smaller substations. A new airport and a new seaport, built by Oleg Deripaska, the tycoon Putin had dressed down at Pikaleva in 2009. Dozens of new hotels, schools, clinics. It was, at the time, the largest construction project on the planet, an effort that in Russia was compared to the reconstruction of ravaged cities after the Great Patriotic War. Anatoly Pakhomov, Sochi's mayor, said that one massive project, to tunnel a second bypass highway to relieve the city's congested traffic, was something that Stalin had proposed more than half a century before. But only now, under Putin, was it being realized. Vladimir Yakunin, Putin's old friend, compared the railroad, built at an expense of nearly $10 billion, to an even older project to unify the nation, the Trans-Siberian Railway, built in the twilight of the Russian Empire by Tsar Alexander III and his son Nicholas II. From the start, Putin had been intimately, obsessively involved in the Olympic project, awarding contracts, often without competitive bidding, approving designs, and policing construction schedules. He visited Sochi repeatedly, on official visits as well as private ones to his dacha at Bacharov Roche, or to a new one built by Gazprom in the mountains. Far more than any other mega-project, Sochi was to symbolize the country's rising wealth, its international prestige, the triumph over terrorism and separatism in the turbulent Northern Caucasus, which was just over the mountain ridge from where the games would take place. For Putin, the Olympics had a purpose deeper than the merely political. He believed them to be a palliative for a country that had suffered so much over the previous decades. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, after the dark and, let us be honest, bloody events in the Caucasus, the public attitude in Russia became very negative and pessimistic, Putin once told a group of foreign journalists. We have to pull ourselves together and realize that we can deliver large-scale projects on time and with high standards. And by projects, I mean not only stronger defense potential, but also developments in the humanitarian sphere, including high achievement in sport. The Olympics, he said, would strengthen the nation's morale. Even Putin's critics acknowledged the scale of the endeavor, though not always so favorably. Konstantin Remchukov, the publisher and editor-in-chief of the independent newspaper Nezavisimaya Gazeta, compared the reconstruction of Sochi to Peter the Great's creation of a new Tsarist St. Petersburg in the 18th century, not simply to replace Moscow as a nation's capital, but to haul the country out of backwardness. We learned in school how it was built on bones, how many mumbled under their breath, how many had to cut off their beards, how unhappy Moscow was that Petersburg was created in some rotten and swampy place, he said. Here, for Putin, it's his Petersburg. Look how he built Sochi in Krasnodar. 50, 60 years will pass, I don't know, and those there will name it Putingrad. As with the nation's strategic industries, Putin had steered the biggest projects to people he trusted or controlled, making them even richer. He would brook no dissent, no delays. After the journalists leave, he chided his assembled subordinates during an unhappy inspection tour photo op in 2012. I will tell what failures to meet the deadlines will amount to. I do not want to frighten anyone, but I will speak with you as people I have known for many years now. And still the construction suffered from delay, disaster, and scandal. Cost overruns, accidents, theft, corruption, abuse. In 2009, a powerful winter storm had destroyed the cargo port built to unload construction materials, along with thousands of meters of barrier walls that would surround the site. Putin had had to fire three successive directors of the main contractor, Olympistrai, before the fourth hung on to the job. Tens of thousands of poorly paid guest workers poured in from Moldova, Ukraine, and Central Asia, fueling resentment among Russians in the region, and many were horribly mistreated, poorly paid, cheated out of wages, and deported home. Dozens died in accidents. Putin wanted the Olympics to be a symbol of Russia, and they were. Corruption plagued every project, driving costs up so high that they became difficult to ignore or hide. Early in 2013, Dmitry Kozak, his close aide, and now the deputy prime minister he had put in charge of Sochi, let it slip in public remarks that the cost of preparing Sochi had ballooned from the $12 billion that Putin had promised the International Olympic Committee to a staggering $51 billion. It was the most expensive Olympics ever, more than seven times the amount Vancouver spent to host the Winter Games in 2010, more than Beijing spent to host the much larger Summer Games in 2008. In a country with an economy that was still struggling, the figure was so politically sensitive that Kozak and other ministers were ordered never to mention the figure again. The profligacy was ridiculed. The Russian edition of Esquire estimated that for the amount spent on the combined highway and railroad to the mountains, engineers could have paved the route with a centimeter of black caviar, 6 centimeters of black truffles, and 22 centimeters of foie gras, among other luxuries. The officials involved blamed the soaring expenses on difficult geological conditions or the demands of the International Olympic Committee, but virtually every project cost far more than comparable projects built elsewhere. There were widespread reports that contractors inflated their prices at every level in order to pay kickbacks to officials, as Valery Morozov had claimed in 2010. The pipeline that Arkady Rotenberg's company constructed under the Black Sea to power the games cost more than $5 million per kilometer, compared to $4 million for the Nord Stream pipeline in the Baltic Sea, which was itself several times more expensive than the European average. Boris Nemtsov called Sochi a festival of corruption, estimating in June 2013 in his newest report on corruption in the Putin era that as much as half of the $51 billion total was squandered or stolen. Even Russian officials acknowledged that enormous sums of money were lost. The auditing chamber estimated at least $500 million in spending was unaccounted for, and then promptly classified its quarterly reports as state secrets. Criminal charges never materialized, though, certainly not against any of Putin's allies, whom the Olympics made very, very wealthy. The costs and the assumption that much of the money had been stolen made many question the wisdom of holding the Olympics. It was a backlash that many host cities experience, but in Russia, the expense was coming at an inauspicious time. Russia's economy still relied heavily on natural resources, and after bouncing back from the worst of the economic crisis, it had stalled again. Growth had slowed from 3% in 2012 to barely over 1% in 2013. The consumer boom fueled by oil prices had not translated into better government services. Putin's approval ratings, an imperfect measurement given the state's grip on the media, slumped in 2013 to the lowest level recorded since he first became president in 2000. According to one agency, Putin's rating had peaked the month after the war in Georgia at 88%, but by now it bumped along at barely above 60%. Even fewer of those questioned had faith in the country's direction or the president's policies, certainly not in the rapacious and ineffective bureaucracy, which seemed to resist even Putin's decrees. On the slopes of Krasnaya Polyana that day in February, Putin's frustration boiled over as he conducted his latest personal inspection tour of venues still scrambling to be ready on schedule. On these tours, said Mayor Pakhomov, Putin rarely expressed appreciation for a job well done. He was a taskmaster who set expectations and was furious when they were not met. Pakhomov spoke of these encounters with awe of the power of Putin's will. Putin was now determined to make a public spectacle of his displeasure. Dressed in a black overcoat, he stood amid a gaggle of his senior aides at the newly completed bobsled center. The head of the Sochi Organizing Committee, Dmitry Chernyshenko, was explaining the seating arrangements when Putin unexpectedly turned the conversation to another venue, the ski jump, which, of all the examples of waste and delay, was about to become the most notorious. The project, called Gornaya Karusel, or Mountain Carousel, was overseen by Ahmed Bilalov, a vice president of the Russian Olympic Committee, who also happened to have owned the land beneath it, and, until recently, shares in the company that had been hired to do the construction. He had sold those to his brother, Bilalov, a businessman from Dagestan who had once served in the Duma, was close to Dmitry Medvedev and his team of advisors. He had been appointed to the Olympic Committee during Medvedev's presidency, as well as to a project that Medvedev hoped would redevelop the Northern Caucasus by building a series of ski resorts, even one in Chechnya, as a way to tame the last remnants of the insurgency in the region by creating economic opportunities. The ski jump had been hampered by poor location, sloppy design, and construction techniques that, according to environmentalists, had probably caused a landslide in 2012 that nearly buried the site. Expensive new retaining walls had to be constructed, as well as a road to the site that had not been in the original contract. The budget for the project, which had begun at $40 million, had ballooned to more than $260 million. And yet, only a year before the Games, it remained a muddy and unfinished construction site, littered with material and debris. The men in Putin's entourage looked uncomfortable. Chernyshenko did not seem to know how to answer Putin's queries about the delays. Putin scanned the men, until Dmitry Kozak finally stepped forward to explain, under Putin's grilling, that it was 2 years behind schedule. Now Putin wanted to know who was responsible. Comrade Bilalov, Kozak replied, as the entourage shifted nervously around him. And what is he up to these days? Kozak stammered that he did not know. Putin turned and glared at the others. Someone said that he now ran the Northern Caucasus Resorts Company and was also on the Russian Olympic Committee, the head of which, Alexander Zhukov, also stood among them. So he's your vice president, is he? He asked. Zhukov could only nod as Putin pressed on relentlessly. And the vice president of the Olympic Committee of the country is engaged in this kind of construction? He owns a construction company of some sort, someone interjected from the back. Putin turned again to Kozak, leading him on like a prosecutor with a reluctant witness. Have there been increases in the cost of the facility's construction? Putin asked. Kozak, now looking at the ground, seemingly unprepared for this interrogation, or perhaps just nervous, detailed the costs generally and the sources of the money. Putin pressed for exact figures, though, and when Kozak gave them, he repeated them disgustedly. Well done, guys, he said, with icy sarcasm that would, of course, feature prominently on state television. Let's move on, He then turned and walked off. Belalov, on Putin's orders, was sacked the next day from all his posts. A swarm of investigations began into his work at the Northern Caucasus resorts, including lavish expenses for him to travel to the Summer Olympics in London in 2012. Belalov, along with his brother Magomed, promptly fled the country, surfacing briefly in April at a clinic in Baden-Baden, Germany, where he said he had elevated levels of mercury in his blood and suspected he had been deliberately poisoned. His doctors later claimed the poison in his body was arsenic and molybdenum. The brothers Belalov relocated to London, while Putin assigned the task of completing the ski jump to Sberbank, headed by German Greff. Putin had known Greff since the 1990s, and, despite his intermittent, oblique critiques of Putin's policies, testifying at Khodorkovsky's trial, for example, trusted him to finish the job. The ski jump was not the only project behind schedule and over budget, and some suspected Putin of singling it out because its owners were tied to Medvedev's team and thus expendable. Others, though, saw the performance as evidence that Putin was, at last, cracking down on the corruption gnawing at Russia, or at least making a show of it to deflect mounting criticism of the Olympic project. Justice remained selective, however, and there were no meaningful prosecutions, even in Belalov's case. Corruption had become so pervasive it was institutionalized. That made it a tool of co-option and coercion. Anyone could be prosecuted, when necessary, because almost everyone was complicit. And even if they were not, they could be charged anyway. The threat of corruption hovered over anyone and thus tamed everyone. In Belalov's case, Putin's concern was less about confronting corruption than with sending a very public warning to those involved in his Olympic dream that they had better finish on time. When he visited the ski jump again in December, this time with Greff in attendance, it had been completed, though ultimately at a great loss to Sberbank's bottom line. On June 23, 2013, an Aeroflot flight from Hong Kong landed in Moscow with what Putin would sardonically call such a present for us for Christmas. On board was Edward Snowden, the young, deeply disillusioned contractor for the National Security Agency, who had handed over to The Guardian and The Washington Post tens of thousands of highly classified documents detailing the pervasive American surveillance of telephones and computer networks, often in collaboration with its allies Canada, Britain, Australia, and New Zealand. Wanted by the United States on espionage charges after his disclosures, Snowden slipped out of Hong Kong after meeting with officials at the Russian consulate there, accompanied by a lawyer for WikiLeaks. Snowden had hoped merely to change planes in Moscow for a flight to Cuba, but the State Department revoked his passport in an effort to cut short his flight. The move backfired when the Chinese let him leave for Moscow anyway. When he arrived at Sheremetyevo Airport, he was effectively stranded without papers. As a result, he spent the next 5 weeks in a diplomatic limbo and under, presumably, the close watch of the FSB. In Washington, officials panicked. They pleaded with Russia to put him on a plane for the United States, while fretting in private over the grave risk that Snowden might share even more of what he knew with the Russians. Putin seemed to relish the unexpected opportunity to chide the Americans. Snowden had committed no crime on Russian soil, he said, during a visit to Finland 2 days later, acknowledging Snowden's presence in the airport's transit lounge. Snowden was a human rights defender who struggles for the freedom of information, Putin said. Ask yourself, do you need to put such people in jail or not? He said he did not want to trouble himself too much with the details of Snowden's case, leaving it to the director of the FSB, Alexander Bortnikov, an old colleague who had joined the KGB in Leningrad in 1975, the same year Putin had. In any case, I would personally prefer not to engage in such matters, because it's like shearing a piglet. A lot of squealing, but little wool. After years of facing criticism from the United States over his record on rights, the irony was sweet. The Russian media hailed Snowden as a hero, comparing him to Andrei Sakharov, his revelations against the United States as noble as Sakharov's against the Soviet Union. 3 weeks into his limbo in the restricted transit area, the Kremlin allowed Snowden a platform to meet lawyers and leaders of rights organizations, including three, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, and Transparency International, whose offices had been raided by Russian investigators as part of the hunt for foreign agents. Snowden read a written statement saying he would seek political asylum rather than return to a country that had violated its own laws. "A little over 1 month ago," he said, "I had family, a home in paradise, and I lived in great comfort. I also had the capability, without any warrant, to search for, seize, and read your communications, anyone's communications at any time. That is the power to change people's fates." Snowden's odyssey was a diplomatic and intelligence coup for Putin. Although the extent of Snowden's cooperation with Russian intelligence agencies remained unknown and was fiercely disputed by his supporters, the FSB closely monitored this unexpected gift. "He is actually surrounded by these people," said Andrei Soldatov, a journalist who wrote extensively about Russia's intelligence agencies and later complained that Snowden could not or would not meet with independent Russian journalists like him. The Snowden affair gave Putin the evidence that confirmed his complaints about American hegemony and perfidy, the hypocrisy of the three American administrations he had now dealt with. Snowden's disclosures tarnished President Obama's reputation and undercut his foreign policy, souring relations even with allies like Germany, whose chancellor, Angela Merkel, learned that her own telephone conversations had been tapped. It also mitigated the disclosures that journalists like Soldatov and his wife, Irina Baragan, had been making about Russia's own extensive surveillance of its citizens through a program called SORM, or the System of Operative Investigative Measures. They described SORM as an Orwellian network that jeopardizes privacy and the ability to use telecommunications to oppose the government. The effort expanded the reach of the intelligence services deeper and deeper into the internet and social media sites that had, until recently, seemed free of government interference. The number of intercepts had doubled since 2007, trapping communications of opposition leaders like Boris Nemtsov and Alexei Navalny, and leaking them to Kremlin-friendly news organizations. Given Snowden's disclosures, how could the United States object to Russia's creeping surveillance state? Almost certainly with Putin's approval, Russia's Migration Service granted Snowden temporary asylum on August 1st, giving him a permit to live and even work in the country. Snowden slipped out of the transit terminal and began a new life in Moscow's shadows. The decision, which the White House learned from news reports, drove a final nail in the reset in relations Obama had pursued with Medvedev, one that had been withering ever since Putin's return to the presidency. A week later, Obama canceled plans to hold a separate meeting with Putin before the G20 summit that had been scheduled in Petersburg for September. Obama's frustration with Putin boiled over. At a press conference, he said there seemed little point in meeting Putin now, given their differences over policies and worldviews. The disputes over missile defense, over the turmoil in the Middle East, over the crackdown on opposition in Russia, the banning of American adoptions, the passage of a new law barring the distribution to children of homosexual propaganda, not to mention the rising tide of anti-Americanism appearing on state television and in official statements. Obama described Putin as sullen and insolent, a taunt that infuriated Putin, according to an aide. "He's got that kind of slouch," Obama said, "looking like the bored kid in the back of the classroom." Obama's aides had convinced themselves that Putin craved the respect that such a meeting of the two world leaders would entail, but Putin acted as if he did not care nearly as much as they assumed. "You cannot dance tango alone," Putin's spokesman, Dmitry Peskov declared. Within weeks, events in Syria proved Peskov right. In August, a barrage of rockets loaded with nerve agents struck a suburb of Syria's capital, Damascus, killing 1,400 people. Obama had warned 2 years before that the use of chemical weapons by Syria's government would cross a red line that would prompt an American military response, and within a week, the Pentagon had drafted plans for a retaliatory missile strike against Syria's army. Putin said nothing publicly, but Russian officials scrambled to muddy the debate, casting doubt on the evidence that President Bashar al-Assad's forces had been responsible. Putin told Britain's Prime Minister, David Cameron, that there was no evidence of whether a chemical attack took place, and if so, who carried it out. Putin had little personal sympathy for Assad. What he vehemently opposed was another American-led attack in the Middle East. He was convinced that from the beginning the United States had been waiting for any pretext to attack and topple Assad, and he was far more resolved in that conviction than Obama was in his determination to punish Syria for the deadliest use of chemical weapons since the Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s. Then, with American airstrikes only hours away, Obama abruptly reversed course, saying he would seek authorization from Congress before mounting an attack. The coalition he had hoped to build had failed to materialize, with even close allies like Britain and Germany refusing to endorse a strike. By the time the leaders of the G20 nations met in Petersburg in September, Obama's international standing was as uncertain as the red line he had drawn against the use of chemical weapons. Putin had been isolated in defense of Assad's brutal crackdown, but now other leaders joined him in insisting that any intervention require the authorization of the United Nations Security Council, where Putin retained the advantage of Russia's veto. Even Pope Francis sent a letter to Putin urging the leaders to lay aside the futile pursuit of a military solution. A month after pointedly canceling his plans to meet separately with Putin, Obama now pulled him aside at Constantine Palace during the G20, and the two sat down in armchairs, accompanied only by their translators. There, Putin laid out a proposal to force Syria to dispose of its chemical stockpiles under international inspection, and Obama agreed. When the idea became public, what little support there had been for another American-led military intervention evaporated. Putin, who had been vilified for his heavy hand after his re-election, was now hailed as a hero who had averted a potentially disastrous escalation of war. Even as Obama continued to seek congressional approval for potential military action, in part to keep the pressure on Assad's government to comply with the inspections, Putin drafted an article that the Kremlin's American public relations firm, Ketchum, managed to place in the New York Times on September 12th. In it, he argued that it was the United States that threatened the international order established after the Great Patriotic War. Its interventions in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Libya had proved ineffective and pointless. Russia did not want to protect Assad's regime so much as international law. Only the United Nations Security Council could authorize the use of force against another country. An American attack against Syria or anything else would constitute an act of aggression, he argued. He ended by disputing Obama's claim to American exceptionalism, made in a nationally televised address explaining his decision not to bomb Syria after all. It is extremely dangerous to encourage people to see themselves as exceptional, whatever the motivation, Putin wrote. In fact, he concluded, we are all different, but when we ask for the Lord's blessing, we must not forget that God created us equal. The article, and its lecturing tone, its unmistakable allusion to the Declaration of Independence, infuriated officials in Washington. Many pointed out Russia's hypocrisy for not having sought authorization for its intervention in Georgia in 2008, and for continuing to supply weapons that allowed Assad's military to crush the rebels. Putin's article also included the unsubstantiated claim that the Syrian rebels had likely used chemical weapons and would use them next on Israel. Yet Putin's gambit had offered a straw to a war-weary United States, and Obama, already facing opposition in Congress, clutched it. NTV began one broadcast by claiming that Putin should win the Nobel Prize for averting an American airstrike. In Russia's controlled discourse, that was hardly surprising, but Putin's stance won plaudits in the United States, too, even if most of them came from conservatives happy to see Obama portrayed as a feckless leader, deftly outmaneuvered on the global stage. A month later, Forbes magazine ranked Putin the most powerful person in the world, passing Obama for the first time. Such rankings are meaningless, but Russia's media repeated it over and over. Anyone watching this year's chess match over Syria and NSA leaks has a clear idea of the shifting individual power dynamics, the Forbes editors wrote. The American blogger, Matt Drudge, called Putin the leader of the free world. An even bigger diplomatic triumph for Putin followed, this time in Ukraine. After years of negotiations that culminated in the fall of 2013, Ukraine had edged closer to an association agreement with the European Union, a treaty that would deepen trade and political ties between the two. Since his election in 2010, Ukraine's president, Viktor Yanukovych, had maintained closer relations with Russia, keeping his country in Russia's orbit. With his popularity fading ahead of the next election in 2015, however, he had revived the possibility of strengthening relations with Europe, something strongly supported by the country's opposition, and he pushed through political reforms that the Europeans had demanded as a condition of signing the agreement. The Europeans were negotiating similar agreements with Moldova, Georgia, and Armenia in the hopes of allowing them all access to the single market of Europe. For diplomats in Europe's capitals, the integration of these economies, with the prospect of full membership in the future, would steadily expand the peaceful, secure European space, an old idea that had become an article of faith in the 21st century. For Putin, however, the expansion of Europe to include Ukraine amounted to an encroachment on Russia that would, in his mind, inevitably be followed by the further encroachment of NATO. Russia's own relations with the bloc had stalled, hampered by the suspicions of many European states, especially those once in the Soviet sphere, over energy policies and human rights. A summit in Yekaterinburg in May had failed to secure an agreement allowing visa-free travel for Russian government officials amid a debate over whether the American Magnitsky sanctions should be adopted on the continent. Putin's own efforts to knit Ukraine more closely to Russia, which he had first proposed to Leonid Kuchma on the eve of the Orange Revolution in 2004, had made little progress, blocked by the internal political divisions in Ukraine. 10 years later, Putin's vision of a trade and economic bloc, with Moscow as its core, had evolved beyond the technical customs agreements negotiated with Belarus and Kazakhstan. One of the first policy declarations he made in 2011 after announcing his return to the Kremlin was the establishment of a broader pact to reunify the economies that had drifted listlessly apart after the Soviet collapse. He called it the Eurasian Economic Union. Excluding the three Baltic nations now ensconced in the EU and NATO, Putin envisioned the bloc not merely as a counterbalance to the European Union, but rather as a new empire unto itself, one that bridged European Russia and the vast steppe that stretched from the Black Sea to Central Asia and Siberia. The Eurasian Union was the manifestation of an ideology that had taken hold among Putin and his inner circle, an ideology that had been missing from the pragmatism that had characterized Putin's rule until then. Eurasianism in Russia was a deeply conservative philosophy, driven underground or abroad by the internationalist ideology of the Soviet Union. It had reemerged in the 1990s, blending the religious and monarchical ideas of exiles like Ivan Ilyin, the philosopher Putin took to quoting, with the geopolitical theories of those like Halfred Mackinder, whose Heartland Theory made Eurasia the pivot area in the battle for control of the world island, the European, Asian, and African landmass. These ideas, championed in articles and books by conservative strategists like Alexander Dugin, spread from the fringes of academic debate and became ever more prominent. They circulated among Putin's closest intimates and were discussed in their late-night meetings. Increasingly, they peppered the public remarks not only of Putin, but of his more powerful advisers. The geopolitics coincided with the emerging conservatism in domestic politics that championed and protected the values of the Orthodox Church, as well as Islam, and resulted in new laws that made blasphemy a crime and that banned the dissemination of homosexual propaganda to children. Vladimir Yakunin, another Putin confidant, viewed efforts to impose the cultural values of the West as a new front in a historic geopolitical struggle between sea and land powers, with Russia, a vast land power, defending its very existence against the United States, the new sea power, much like Mackinder theorized. He described the American dominance of geopolitics and world finance as a conspiracy to suppress any potential competitors, which is what made the Eurasian Union, he believed, so threatening to the West. Russia was, is, and will be some kind of geopolitical competitor to the interests of Anglo-Saxon civilization, he said. The irony of the new ideology was that Russia's elite, especially those who could afford it, had become thoroughly westernized, taking vacations and owning properties in the nations whose values they reviled. Even Yakunin's son lived in London, prompting a satirical blog from Alexei Navalny. Down the voracious throat of the odious West, which is devoid of spiritual values, Vladimir Ivanovich Yakunin threw his dearest possession, excluding his love for Vladimir Putin, his family. In September, fresh from the diplomatic triumph over Syria's chemical weapons, Putin described the Euro-Atlantic countries as dangerously adrift from their Christian roots. They are denying moral principles and all traditional identities, national, cultural, religious, and even sexual. They are implementing policies that equate large families with same-sex partnerships, belief in God with a belief in Satan. The excesses of political correctness have reached the point where people are seriously talking about registering political parties whose aim is to promote pedophilia. Worse, he said, these nations wanted to export these dangerous ideas. It was a direct path to degradation and primitivism, resulting in a profound demographic and moral crisis. Of all the countries Putin hoped to unite in the Eurasian Union, none was as important as Ukraine, with its deep historical, social, and religious ties to Russia. Many Ukrainians were ethnic Russians, sundered in Putin's view from their homeland by the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century. And now Ukraine was turning toward the embrace of the European Union, encouraged by the Europeans and the Americans at the expense of his Eurasian Union. It was evidence enough for Putin when Hillary Rodham Clinton warned in December 2012 that the Eurasian Union was merely an attempt to subjugate its neighbors in a new Soviet-like alliance. And we are trying to figure out effective ways to slow down or prevent it. The European Union set a deadline for Ukraine to adopt the trade agreement before its summit in Lithuania in November. And in the months leading up to it, Putin exerted enormous effort to persuade Ukraine to resist. As he had before the Orange Revolution in 2004, he visited repeatedly. In July 2013, to highlight the religious ties that bound Ukraine to Russia, he attended a ceremony in Kyiv to commemorate the anniversary of the baptism of Prince Vladimir in 988. "We are all spiritual heirs of what happened here 1,025 years ago," Putin said, appearing with Yanukovych at the Monastery of the Caves, one of the holiest sites of Orthodoxy. he used economic levers too. Within weeks of the anniversary, Russia banned the import of Ukrainian railcars and candies manufactured by Roshen, a confectionery owned by an oligarch and former minister Petro Poroshenko, who favored closer integration with Europe. In August, Russia virtually halted all commercial traffic across its border with Ukraine by overzealously enforcing the customs rules of Russia's union with Belarus and Kazakhstan. It was a very public way of making the point that Ukraine's economic future would be much easier if it joined Russia's union, not Europe's. Putin's special envoy on Ukraine, the former presidential challenger Sergei Glazeyev, traveled to Yalta in September and warned at a conference that Ukraine's embrace of Europe would amount to suicide. "Signing this treaty," he said ominously, "will lead to political and social unrest." He later provided Yanukovych with a Russian translation of the 1,000 pages of the European Union's agreement, which, evidently, the Ukrainians had not translated, and warned him that adopting it would mean that Russia would have to close its borders to avoid an influx of European goods. Putin was said to dislike Yanukovych, a physically imposing but unprincipled leader who he felt was betraying him by flirting with the Europeans. Putin met him in late October and again in early November, icily explaining that an agreement with the European Union would cost Ukraine dearly. The losses it was already feeling because of the customs enforcement would pale in comparison to the billions of dollars in economic pain that the country would suffer from the new barriers to the Russian market and higher prices for natural gas. After the last of those meetings, Yanukovych's negotiating partners in Europe noticed a change in his demeanor. They suspected Putin had threatened something more than economic pain, presenting him with kompromat that he would not want made public. Yanukovych's venality, the insider deals that enriched him, his family, and his close business associates, certainly made him vulnerable. It was not blackmail, a senior Kremlin advisor insisted later, but a sober analysis of how deeply intertwined the economies of the two countries were. In his meeting with the Europeans, Yanukovych now insisted that Ukraine stood to lose $160 billion in trade with Russia and higher energy prices, an improbable figure nearly equal to the country's gross domestic product. It was a last desperate ploy by Yanukovych to persuade the Europeans to sweeten their offer, but the Europeans balked. Putin had triumphed. On November 21st, a week before the summit in Lithuania, Yanukovych's government stunned his European counterparts and many in Ukraine by announcing that his country would back out of the agreement, a reversal that upended months of intensive talks. Yanukovych's announcement provoked outrage among those Ukrainians who envisioned closer ties with Europe as an inevitable evolution from their country's Soviet past. That night, 1,000 protesters rallied in Kiev's main plaza, Maidan Nezalezhnosti. Yulia Tymoshenko issued a jailhouse statement urging people to react as they would to a coup d'etat and take to the streets. The next day, a few thousand more did. By the weekend, the crowds had swelled and tents were erected, as they had been after the fraudulent election in 2004. Only this time, the flags that fluttered in the streets were not orange, but blue with a circle of yellow stars, the banner of the European Union. They called their protest Euromaidan, and it reflected the clash of ideals among the country's 46 million people. The protesters soon turned their fury on the statue of Lenin that still stood at the end of Kiev's main avenue. Lenin was not simply an anachronism. He was a manifestation of the lingering dominance of Moscow. Yanukovych did little to defuse the protests at first, content to wait them out with the onset of winter. Early in December, as the protests intensified, he flew to China, touting trade deals he hoped would mollify the anger over rejecting an economic partnership with the Europeans. He stopped in Sochi to meet Putin on the way back, and there he secured a secret deal that would not be announced until December 17th, when they again appeared together in the Kremlin. Putin announced that Russia would give Ukraine a cash infusion worth $15 billion by tapping Russia's National Wealth Fund to purchase Ukrainian bonds. Gazprom would slash the price of natural gas from $400 per cubic meter to $268. Putin emphasized disingenuously that he had not insisted that Ukraine join the Eurasian Union as a condition, though many suspected he and Yanukovych had agreed that this would happen at a later date, once the popular anger had subsided. Putin then made special note of his plans to celebrate the 70th anniversary of the liberation of Sevastopol, the port city in Crimea, from the Nazis in 1944. Those celebrations would ultimately take place on May 9, 2014, though not in circumstances that anyone anticipated that wintry day in Moscow. Putin once again seemed to have outmaneuvered his rivals, securing a diplomatic victory over the Europeans. Ahead of the Olympics, Putin sought to be magnanimous at home. After a year of harsh crackdowns and repressive new laws, the Kremlin signaled a thaw in the summer of 2013. In July, the court in Kirov had convicted Navalny of the embezzlement charges, but then, after a confusing night that included protests and frantic consultations between the Kremlin and the court, he was freed with only a suspended sentence. The Kremlin then allowed Navalny to campaign, at first furtively, then openly, as a candidate in Moscow's mayoral election in August, against the incumbent Sergei Sobyanin. It was the first campaign for the position since Putin had abolished elections for regional leaders after Beslan in 2004. Sobyanin, after Yuri Lushkov's dismissal in 2010, hoped to establish his own political legitimacy and resigned early in order to win the office in what he vowed would be a free and fair election. Despite the by now familiar harassment of challengers and the use of government resources on behalf of the incumbent, the election that unfolded was certainly fairer than most had been in Russia for more than a decade, as even Putin's critics pointed out. Navalny modeled his campaign on one he had watched on the American television series The Wire, stumping for votes in speeches in public places around the city in a way that few candidates ever had in Russia. 2 years of diminishing public protests had done nothing to weaken Putin's grip on power. Now he seemed confident enough to relax some of the pressure he had exerted to suffocate the opposition. When the ballots in the mayor's race were counted, Sobyanin won, but Navalny drew 27% of the vote, a respectable showing that was far higher than polls had predicted. He thus established himself as the country's most prominent opposition leader, and yet not one who posed a formidable or imminent threat to Putin's political control. The thaw continued in December, when at Putin's instigation, the Duma adopted a law to grant amnesty to thousands of prisoners. Many of them had been convicted for economic crimes imposed to strip them of property or businesses, but the list of those eligible for amnesty included more prominent political prisoners as well. The two members of Pussy Riot, Nadezhda Tolikonikova and Maria Alochina, walked free a few months before their sentences ended. So did a few of those charged in the Bologna Square protests. The courts then amnestied 30 Greenpeace International activists who had been arrested in September 2013 after their ship, Arctic Sunrise, mounted a high seas protest against Russia's first offshore oil rig in the Kara Sea. The biggest surprise of all, however, was the release of Mikhail Khodorkovsky in October. He marked his 10th year in prison, and Russian prosecutors had recently announced that they were pursuing yet another criminal case against him, suggesting he might never be freed. And yet, 2 years of secret negotiations brokered by Germany cleared a path to freedom. As part of the deal, Khodorkovsky appealed to Putin in two letters that he had written in November. They have never been made public. Although Putin had at first demanded that Khodorkovsky acknowledge his guilt, he agreed to accept his plea for clemency on humanitarian grounds, citing his mother's declining health. "He has already spent more than 10 years in confinement. This is a serious punishment," Putin said at his annual press conference in December. The broader amnesty appeared now, in hindsight, to have been engineered to accomplish the release of the man whose arrest in 2003 had signaled a dark turn in the country's modern history. A few hours after Putin spoke in Moscow, Khodorkovsky was awoken at 2 o'clock in the morning in Karelia, where he had spent the last years of his detention. He was put on a plane and flown first to Petersburg and then to Berlin, another exile from the new Russia. The next day he appeared at the Checkpoint Charlie Museum, devoted to the dissident heroes of the Cold War and the victims of the divisions represented by the Berlin Wall. Grayer, his hair shorn, Khodorkovsky looked like someone who had walked in from the cold and dark into a brightly lit and overheated room. A journalist who was there, Arkady Ostrovsky, wrote. Khodorkovsky, who had spent so much of his time in prison reading and writing, sounded neither broken nor bitter. "In all these years, all the decisions about me were taken by one man, Vladimir Vladimirovich Putin. So today, it is hard to say I am grateful. I have thought quite a bit about what words would express what I think. I am happy at his decision. I think that's it." As a condition of his release, he had agreed not to become involved in politics for a year, though he vowed to be active in forging a civil society in Russia from afar. "The Russian problem is not just the president as a person," he said. "The problem is that our citizens in the large majority don't understand that they have to be responsible for their own fate. They are so happy to delegate it to, say, Vladimir Vladimirovich Putin, and then they will entrust it to somebody else, and I think that for such a big country as Russia, this is the path to a dead end." Khodorkovsky's release was intended to look less like an expulsion of a dissident than an act of mercy, the benevolence of a czar. Many, including Khodorkovsky and the women of Pussy Riot, saw the amnesties as part of the Kremlin's efforts to take some of the edge off growing international criticism before the Olympics in Sochi, now less than 2 months away. Putin's pressure on Ukraine, the strengthening of laws against political opponents, the homophobic legislation and statements of some lawmakers and officials, the scandalously expensive preparations of the venues in Sochi, and the punitive anti-terrorist operations in the Caucasus leading up to it, all had come under withering attack. World leaders, including Barack Obama, Angela Merkel, and David Cameron, made it clear they would not be attending the games, lest their attendance be seen as endorsing Putin's rule. Polishing Russia's image was certainly part of the motive behind Putin's actions. They also demonstrated his singular power to bend branches of power to his will. Even other countries would succumb. Putin granted the amnesties the way he granted the contracts to build Sochi to the tycoons he trusted. The way he could, without debate, spend $15 billion of the nation's rainy day fund to keep Yanukovych's government under Moscow's sway. Khodorkovsky was right. Putin did what he did on his own, because the people had entrusted him to rule, to be the ultimate leader, the czar of a simulated democracy. There was no one now, from the ordinary Russian to the apparatchiks who were complicit in the political and economic system he had built, who would or could take the responsibility to change things. On the night of February 7, 2014, Putin, in one short sentence prescribed by the Olympic Charter, opened the Winter Games in Sochi. Not everything had been completed in time, despite a breakneck effort that continued even after the sporting events began. The unfinished sidewalks were hastily covered. Fields of construction debris were hidden behind crisp blue billboards. The failure to complete many hotels, especially those where foreign journalists stayed, threatened to turn the event into a public relations debacle. A campaign to round up stray dogs, presumably to euthanize them, became the most prominent meme of the pre-opening coverage in the media, after the colossal expense of rebuilding Sochi and the threat of terrorism, punctuated at the end of December by two suicide bombings in Volgograd that killed 34 people. There was an element of schadenfreude in some of the coverage of Russia's bloated and brutal preparations. There was also genuine international concern over Russia's regressive new laws, especially those regarding blasphemy and homosexual propaganda, and the smothering of protests that continued up to and through the opening ceremony. 2 days before the games commenced, more than 200 writers from 30 countries published an open letter in The Guardian calling for the repeal of laws stifling free expression that had been passed since Putin returned to the presidency. Four winners of the Nobel Prize, Günter Grass, Wole Soyinka, Elfriede Jelinek, and Orhan Pamuk, were among the signatories. Publicly, Putin feigned indifference to the criticism, small and large, but it was said to have infuriated him. In an interview in Kommersant, Dmitry Peskov, his spokesman, dismissed the complaints of corruption and waste as exaggerations. "Come to Sochi," he said, "and look at what had been built." It was proof enough that, at the very least, not all the money was stolen. He recounted a conversation with a very wise person, clearly meaning Putin. "This wise person said, 'Do you know when everyone will love us and cease to criticize us and so on, including criticizing us for no reason?' And I asked, 'When?' And he said, 'When we dissolve our army, when we concede all our natural resources to them as a concession, and when we sell all of our land to Western investors, that's when they will cease to criticize us.'" In fact, the criticism waned once the games began. The opening ceremony was a lavish, dazzling expression of Putin's Russian ideal, choreographed by the head of Channel One, Konstantin Ernst, who also directed the annual Victory Day parades on Red Square and Putin's annual press conferences. The spectacle, called Dreams of Russia and lasting nearly 3 hours, began with a young girl named Lubov, or Love, reciting the Cyrillic alphabet. With each letter came a projection representing famous artists, inventors, and places. B for Baikal, S for Sputnik, P for the periodic table of Mendeleev, and so on. Some were émigrés whose works had once been considered deviant or traitorous, including Chagall, Kandinsky, and Nabokov, but who were now reinstalled in the pantheon of a glorious Russian history. Lubov was then swept through the country's vast history and geography, from the empire of Peter the Great, the letter E for Imperia, to war and peace, represented by a dazzling ballet from the onion domes of St. Basil's Cathedral, to a luminescent troika that Gogol made a metaphor for Russia in Dead Souls. "Russia, whither are you rushing? Answer, it gives no answer." The ceremony did not ignore the Bolsheviks, the terror, or the Gulag completely, but it did not dwell on them. The ceremony was a manifestation of the national idea at the center of Putin's political construct, one that somehow adapted the best of the country's turbulent past and turned the arc of history into something people could be proud of, not ashamed. The only glitch in the ceremony came when five illuminated snowflakes unfolded into the rings of the Olympic symbol. One flake failed, but adroit television producers swiftly replaced the image with one from a rehearsal. No one watching on Russian television knew what had happened. The final journey of the Olympic torch, which, in keeping with the superlative narrative of these games, had traversed the country from the bottom of Lake Baikal to outer space, included some of Russia's famous Olympians. The most noted of them was the gold medal winner from Athens in 2004, Alina Kabayeva. the Olympics served the political purpose Putin intended. Even Alexei Navalny, whose anti-corruption organization had published an interactive website on the titanic waste involved, found himself moved by the opening ceremony. "It's so sweet and so uniting." As the attention turned to the sports, as Putin and his aides had always insisted it should, the Olympics even seemed to temper some of the harshest criticism of him and his rule. Putin himself rushed from event to event, reveling in the sports and the attention. He posed for photo ops with the athletes, drank beer at the Dutch House with King Willem Alexander of the Netherlands, and even paid a visit to Team USA, ostentatiously making the point that despite his political differences with the United States, he welcomed their participation, and that he was a bigger man than Obama, who had declined to attend. He had achieved his dream. Russia was at the global center of gravity, a rich, indispensable, united nation playing host to the world. Russia, in his mind, had achieved the glory, the respect, that the Soviet Union had had when he was a boy, when Gagarin was in space, when the Red Army was formidable and feared. And yet, beneath the spectacle and the sports, there was an undercurrent of unease and fear. The national unity on display in Sochi, however genuine, did nothing to keep the steady, firm hand of the state from throttling any sign of dissent. The protests in Ukraine, which had not dissipated over the winter, reverberated in Moscow like a distant earthquake, faintly but ominously shaking the ground. In the weeks before the Games, Putin moved preemptively to quarantine any new outbreak of the protest contagion inside Russia. In December, he decreed a makeover of RIA Novosti, the state news organization that under Medvedev had earned respect for balance and a diversity of points of view. In January, a liberal television station called Dozhd, or Rain, was dropped by the nation's cable providers after asking in an online poll whether more lives might have been saved in Leningrad if the Red Army had surrendered the city and retreated instead of enduring 872 days of siege at the cost of 1 million dead. Having reconstructed Putin's Olympian ideal of Russia's history, the Kremlin seemed determined to silence anyone who might contradict it. In defiance of the Olympic Charter's promotion of freedom of expression, the police from Petersburg to the Caucasus arrested scores of people who had tried to protest for one reason or another on the day of the opening ceremony. In the middle of the games, a court in Krasnodar sentenced an activist with Environmental Watch on the North Caucasus to 3 years in prison, while other members of the group were detained to keep them from presenting a report they had compiled on the ecological damage wrought by the construction in Sochi. The women of Pussy Riot reunited in Sochi with a new protest song, "Putin Will Teach You to Love the Motherland," and were immediately set upon by horsewhip-wielding Cossacks and then detained by the police, who claimed they were investigating a theft from their hotel. A documentary, "The Biochemistry of Betrayal," appeared on Rossiya at the height of the games on February 18th, equating the opposition in Russia to the Soviet commander, Lieutenant General Andrei Vlasov, who collaborated with the Nazis after being captured in 1942. When the trial of eight arrested at the Bologna protest in 2012 ended with convictions as the games climaxed, 212 people were arrested in the streets outside the courthouse. When their sentences were announced 3 days later, there were more protests and 232 more arrests, including, once again, Alexei Navalny and the women of Pussy Riot. Putin had invested so much in the Olympics that any criticism of it, any protest that might question its benefit, was treated as blasphemous, an act of treason against a resurgent state. In a column on the website of Yezhodnevny Journal, the satirist Viktor Shenderovich, whose portrayal of Putin had knocked his puppet show Kukli off the air in 2000, mused about the pride he felt in Russia during the Olympics, worrying that impulses like his would only enhance and even embolden Putin's power. He wondered whether a critic like himself could cheer guiltlessly for the Russian team, whose first gold medal in team figure skating came after a dazzling performance and questionable voting by the judges by a 15-year-old competitor, Yulia Lipnitskaya. Shenderovich's column explained that he, too, had enjoyed the girl on skates, but he reminded readers of Germany's enthusiasm for Hans Völker, a star in the 1936 Olympics in Berlin. A smiling guy, a handsome man, symbolizing the youth of the new Germany. Something, however, prevents us from enjoying his victory today. He did not explain Völker's fate explicitly, but he mentioned Dachau and the bombing of Coventry, the siege of Leningrad, and a lesser-known massacre at Khatyn, near Minsk, the capital of what is now Belarus. The entire village was brutally executed in 1943 in retaliation for a partisan attack on a convoy of the Nazis' 118th Auxiliary Police Battalion. Völker, one of the battalion's officers, was killed in the attack. The Nazi massacre was a notorious war crime that the Soviet Union publicized and that Shenderovich's readers would certainly remember. "Not the fault of Hans, of course," he wrote, "but it turned out that he contributed." Shenderovich meant to be provocative, excessively so, perhaps, but his allusion to the Nazis provoked a furious backlash at a time when Russia was portraying the street protests in Ukraine as nothing less than an uprising of neo-Nazis. The reaction was swift and savage. Shenderovich was denounced in print and on air. The day after his column appeared, the Russia channel broadcast snips of a video of him masturbating in bed with a woman who was not his wife. A few weeks later, the journal's website was shut down, along with the opposition portals Grani.ru and Kasparov.ru. The Kremlin, having once largely ignored the permissive ethos of the Internet, had come to understand the threat it posed. It had tightened the screws with regulations against promoting extremism, and now evoked them more vigorously than at any time in Putin's era. The crackdown against dissent, the campaign of denunciation so fulsome that it could only have been orchestrated by the Kremlin's media handlers, felt as if the country was being mobilized for war once again.